killed thrice for my son. I lost two boys. I couldn't bear to lose my last, she said.
Gavin could hardly believe her.
Once I got a blackguard who suspected him, reassigned to a dangerous post during the Redcliffe uprising, where I knew he would be killed. Once I directed pirates to the ship Dervani Malagos was taking home after having been lost in the wilds of Tyria for years. He claimed to have been closest to the conflagration at Sundered Rock and to have seen things no one else had. I tried to buy him off, but he slipped away. And once I hired an assassin during the Thorn conspiracies, using the cover of someone else's fight to murder someone who was about to blackmail my son.
Gavin was speechless. In the first year of his masquerade, he'd killed three men to protect his identity and exiled a dozen more, then two in the seventh year. He hadn't killed anyone in cold blood since, until Bass. He'd known his mother had protected him, but he'd always thought she'd done it by passing on information she'd learned. His mother had always been fiercely protective, but he'd never imagined how far she would go, how far he would force her to go because he'd supplanted Dazen.
Dear Orholm, how I wish I believed in you, that you might forgive me for what I've done. Each time, she said, I told myself I was serving Orholm and the Seven Satrapies and not just my family, but my conscience has never been clear.
Shaken, he intoned the traditional words, offering her forgiveness. She stood, looking at him intently.
Now, son, there are a few things you should know before I lay my burdens down.
She didn't wait for him to say anything, which was good because he didn't think he was capable of it.
You are not the evil son, Dazen. You are errant, but never mean-spirited. You are a true prism, errant. I murdered the White Oaks. I did you? She interrupted, sharp.
Then softer.
I've seen that poison eating you for 16 years. And always you've refused to talk. Tell me what happened.
His mother really was a guile, if not by blood, by temperament. She'd wanted to talk about this all along.
I can't. If not me, who? If not now, when? Dazen, I'm your mother. Let me give you this.
His tongue felt like lead, but the images were there before his eyes in an instant. The leering faces of the White Oak brothers. The surge of fear paralyzing him. Gavin licked his lips, but he couldn't force the first words out. He felt the hatred once more, fury at the injustice. 7-on-1, more. The lies.
Things were already bad with Gavin.
Blue and green awoke for me early.
I was starting to suspect I could do more.
I told him. You know, we hadn't been close since he'd been announced prism-elect, and somehow Sebastian's murder only made things worse. I guess I thought telling him my gifts were growing would bring him back. Like we could be best friends again. But he didn't like it.
Not at all.
From nowhere a wash of tears came to Gavin's eyes. He missed his brother so much it tore his soul.
I understand now how threatening it must have been for a young man to lose the one thing that made him special.
I didn't then. The day after I told him I was a polychrome, I heard him urging father to betroth him to Caris. It was the greatest betrayal I could imagine.
Her love was the one thing that made me special.
It was some time before I saw the symmetry to that. Anyway, I thought Caris was as in love with me as I was with her. When father announced her betrothal to Gavin, we decided to run away together.
She must have told someone.
Maybe it was an accident. Maybe Gavin seemed a better prize. Caris and I were supposed to meet just outside her family's mansion after midnight. She wasn't there. Her maid told me she was inside. It was a trap, of course. The White Oak brothers knew I'd been trysting with Caris, and they wanted to teach me a lesson. Said I'd dishonored them, turned their sister into a whore. They'd grabbed him as soon as he stepped inside. All 7 brothers. They'd torn off his cloak and snatched away his spectacles and his sword. He remembered the great enclosed courtyard, servants peeking out from doors and windows. There was a great bonfire in the courtyard, plenty of light, but none for a blue-green bichrome without spectacles.
They started beating me.
They'd been drinking, several were drafting red. It got out of hand. I thought,
still think,
that they were going to kill me. I got away once, but the gate I tried was chained shut.
They chained the gates?
Feliagile asked. It had become part of the story that Dazen had done that, out of cruelty. Karis's father had known better, but had said nothing to combat the lie. They didn't want me to get out, or any guards or soldiers from the outside to be able to get in, to interfere before they were done. Gavin got quiet, glanced at his mother. Her face was all tenderness. He looked away. I split light for the first time that night. It felt wonderful. I'd thought I might be a superviolet to yellow polychrome, but that night I used red. A lot of red. Maybe I wasn't ready for what red does to you when you're already furious. He remembered the shock on their faces when he started drafting. They knew he was a blue-green. They knew what he was doing was impossible. There was only one prism each generation. Images of fireballs streaking from his bleeding hands, of Kolos White Oak's skull smoking while he still stood, of the White Oak guards slaughtered by the dozen, limbs sheared off, blood everywhere. I killed the brothers and all the White Oak guards. The fires were spreading. The front gate collapsed as I got out. I heard people screaming. He'd gone, staggering, left, empty and numb to find his horse. There was a maid at the side door, the woman who'd lured me into the trap. She looked through the bars and begged me to open it. It was the same door I'd tried when I was trying to get out. It was chained on the inside, but she didn't have the key. I told her to burn, and I left. I didn't realize. I didn't even think that all the other doors were chained, too. I just wanted to get away. They couldn't find the keys in time, I guess. With that casual cruelty, I consigned 100 innocents to death. Like it was better for the guilty to die than for the innocent to live. Funny thing, he could weep about not being friends with his brother, but he had nothing inside himself for all those dead innocents. Slaves and servants bound to the White Oaks not by choice. Children. It was just too monstrous. And most of the men who joined Dazen in the war later hadn't even asked what had happened that night. They'd been happy to fight for a man whom they thought had killed an entire mansion full of people, because it meant he was indestructible. How he despised them. His mother came and held him. And now, silently, he wept. Perhaps for those dead. Perhaps only selfishly, because he was losing her.
Dazen, it isn't mine to absolve you of what happened that night, or of all that happens in war that you carry still, but I do forgive you of all that I can. You are no monster. You are a true prism, and I love you.
She trembled, tears streaking down her cheeks, but she glowed. She kissed Gavin on the lips, something she hadn't done since he was a boy.
I'm proud of you, Dazen. Proud to be your mother, she said. Sebastian would be proud of you, too.
He held her, weeping. There was no absolution for him. Sebastian was still dead, and her other son rotted in a hell Gavin had created for him. She wouldn't have forgiven that. But he wept, and she held him, soothing him like a child once more. Then, all too soon, she pushed him back.
It's time, she said.
She took a deep breath.
Is it acceptable for me to draft one last time? It's been years.
Absolutely, Gavin said, trying to put himself back together. He gestured to the orange panel of the wall. She drew in orange Luxin, shivered, sighed.
It feels like life, doesn't it?
She knelt gracefully.
Remember what I said, she said.
Everything, he swore, even if I don't believe it.
It's all right, she said. You'll believe it someday.
He blinked. Feliagile chuckled.
You don't get all your smarts from your father, you know.
I never doubted it. She drew her hair back over her shoulders to give him a clear path to her heart. She placed her hand on his thigh, looked up at him. She let the orange Luxin go.
I'm ready, she said.
I love you, Gavin said. He took a deep breath. Felia Guile, you gave the full measure. Your service will not be forgotten, but your failures are hereby blotted out, forgotten, erased. I give you absolution. I give you freedom. Well done, good and faithful servant. He stabbed her in the heart. Then he held her, kneeling with her, kissing her face as she died. It was several long minutes before he had the strength to stand and summon the blackguards. When they opened the door, he saw that there were 100 drafters in the hall waiting for him. They weren't smiling. The enormous Usef Tep, the purple bear, stepped forward.
"We didn't want to cause a disturbance while you were with your mother. But, sir, we need to talk."
"Sir, not Lord Prism, not Gavin. So begins the end."
Chapter 80
"Kip, whatever happens, stay close to me," Caris whispered, leaning close. She said it with a tension and certainty that told Kip something was going to happen. Soon. Though he wanted to, he didn't ask. Their guards were close, though everyone's attention was focused on Lord Rainbow up front and his verbal feces about duty and justice. Kip had long ago stopped paying attention. He was staring at a girl not 10 paces away. Liv. He could have sworn she'd been pushing closer to him and Caris for a while, but for the last 10 minutes she'd stood as though frozen, listening to Lord Rainbow. The crowd between them moved, and he saw that she was wearing yellow cloth vambraces. Liv was a yellow. It had to be her. Kip craned his head around, looking toward Brightwater Wall.
"Stop acting suspicious," Caris said through gritted teeth,
which left Kip with absolutely zero places to look. If he stared at Liv, that would draw attention to her. The speech disgusted him. He couldn't look at the wall, and when he looked at Caris, he couldn't help but notice her dress. Caris had been thought-freezingly gorgeous when Kip had seen her wrapped in a heavy black cloak over her blackguard garb. In the thin black dress she was wearing, her beauty ripped Kip's breath out of his chest, stomped on it, and set it on fire. She stood straight, imperious, regal, elegance personified. No one had given her a shawl despite the coolness of the night. In the rising light, Kip could see the goose flesh on her arms.
"Cold out, huh?" he said.
One of their guards snorted.
"I will beat you to death if you ask for it," Caris said,
still staring straight ahead. Kip had no idea what she was talking about, or why the guard was laughing.
"What did—"
He looked down at her chest. Her nipples were clearly defined against the thin silk. Kip gaped just as she looked over and caught him looking.
"Kip, dark spectacles are not a license to ogle."
"Will the earth please open and swallow me now?" She thought he'd been snarky about—
Oh, Orholm, he was the stupidest boy in history.
The speech ended without anything special happening. Kip glanced carefully at Caris. She looked toward the east, where the sky was lightening.
"He's waiting until it's almost dawn," Caris whispered,
as their guards pushed them to start walking.
"Be ready."
"He?" Kip asked.
"Shut it,"
the mirror man to Kip's left said. He smacked Kip with the butt of his musket. "Oh, I can make inappropriate jokes on accident, but you've got a problem when I'm just trying to escape?" At first, Kip couldn't see very well where they were going through the vast crowd. Gradually, though, he saw that the drafters were joining a much larger group that was being addressed by King Hardul. Kip lost sight of Liv quickly. The dark spectacles he was wearing made him almost blind. He could see out of the sides if he strained, but it made it impossible to search the crowd. With his hands tied behind his back, there was no way to fix that either. Tens of thousands of soldiers surrounded King Hardul. The man was waving his arms, shouting, but Kip could only hear snippets as the drafters joined the outskirts of that group.
"Cleanse this city! Take back what has been stolen from us! Punish!"
It sounded pretty grim. Again, Kip seemed to be the only person who wasn't hanging on every word, so as the sun rose, first touching Brightwater Wall behind them because it was higher than the plain below, he saw movement on the wall. He couldn't see it well around the frame of the spectacles, but the forms of five men, a cannon crew, became three. Then, in a violent motion, two. Then, just one. The cannon on the wall had been pointed at a high trajectory toward Garriston, but the man was angling it down and down. A quick spark. Boom! The cannon spat fire. Kit didn't see the shell hit, but he felt it. The earth seemed to jump. For a moment no one did anything, thinking it must have been a mistake. Screams of fright and pain. Then Karis collided with him, knocking him off his feet. Kip smacked his head as he fell, so at first he wasn't sure if the second explosion was just his imagination.
"Canister shot!" Karis said. "Shit! We have to move! Iron Fist's aiming for that wagon!"
Wagon? Iron Fist? Why was Iron Fist shooting at them? Kip was blinking. Something was strange about his vision. Oh, smacking his head against the ground had knocked one of the black lenses out of the frame of his spectacles.
"Grab that lens and cut my hands free," Karis barked.
They were both lying on the ground, hands bound. The crackle of musket fire filled the air. One of the Mirrorman guards grabbed Kip, trying to haul him to his feet. Despite lying flat on her back, Karis kicked the back of the man's knee with her left foot. He folded, and by the time he landed on his back, her right foot had swept up and then down in an axe kick across his throat. There was a crunch, and blood sprayed through the male flap over the man's mouth. Kip could hardly believe what he'd just seen, but Karis was already moving on. She scrambled over the dying man, lying right on top of him. With her hands still behind her back, she drew the man's belt knife a hand's breadth and cut her wrists free.
"Stop!"
a Mirrorman yelled. His musket pointed at Karis's head. There was still screaming everywhere, chaos, shouting and gunfire, and the screams of the dying. Kip lashed out, kicking for the Mirrorman's knee, as Karis had done seconds before. The Mirrorman saw it coming, and swung the butt of his musket for Kip's leg, and was flung away like Orholm's own hand had slapped him. A concussion, a roar, a pressure so vast Kip's vision went black for an instant. Everyone standing was torn off their feet. Things, Kip couldn't even tell what they were, blasted overhead. He must have lost a few seconds. He rolled over, tried to stand, fell. His wrists were bloody but no longer bound. The acrid aroma of gunpowder filled the air. Bits of wood rained down on the ground. When Kip tried to stand again, someone helped him. Not even 100 paces away where the powder wagon had been, he saw a crater in the ground a good 10 paces across and at least 2 paces deep. Everyone in a huge circle around it was dead. Karis turned him around, her mouth moving, skin smudged with powder. He couldn't hear her. He saw her mouth a curse, so she realized the same thing. He was pretty sure she was mouthing Iron Fist and a series of curses. She put a musket in his hands and said, slowly enough that Kip could read her lips, "Can you walk?" Kip nodded, not sure how much he was hearing her and how much he was reading her lips. She pulled at him and they started jogging. He was still disoriented, but he saw that he wasn't the only one. Dozens of men and women with powder-darkened skin and clothes were staggering around, some of them bleeding from their ears. A man was carrying his left hand in his right hand, looking for the rest of his arm as blood pumped out of his mangled shoulder. Teams of soldiers were forming up now and running toward the wall. Others stood back and were firing their muskets at the gun emplacement, but Kip didn't see anyone on top of the wall returning fire. Someone was shouting at Kip. Good, so he could hear. He turned. He didn't recognize the soldier standing in front of him.
"Form up, soldier!"
the man shouted.
"Move it!"
They thought he was a soldier because he had a musket. But then with his powder-blackened clothes, it was no wonder.
"Come on, soldier, we've got a city to take!"
There were at least 20 soldiers with the man, and only the officer had a real uniform. Kip shot a glance at Karis. She was wobbling back and forth, holding her hands over her eyes like she was blind, just another wounded person. Kip realized that if they saw the violet caps over her eyes, they'd capture her immediately, or kill her outright. With that dress, it was best not to let their attention alight on her any longer than necessary. If Kip refused, the man could summarily execute him, and he looked grim, ready to do it.
"Yes, sir,"
Kip said. He joined the lines, glanced at Karis, looked once more for Liv and didn't see her, and then ran with the soldiers toward the city and the sound of guns and the flash of magic. Chapter 81 Gavin squared his shoulders and confronted his accusers, a hallway in the Travertine Palace. It wasn't exactly where he would have picked to die, but he supposed it was better than some dungeon somewhere. Better than I gave you, Gavin. At least he could face this with dignity. "What do you want?" he demanded.
"We know what you're doing,"
Usef Tep said.
"Sir."
The sir was belated. It always was with the purple bear. Samilla Sire came forward, put a hand on Usef's meaty arm.
"We've come together to stop you, Gavin Gile."
"And how do you propose to do that?" Gavin asked.
"By volunteering."
"Huh?" Gavin tottered on the edge of drafting everything he could. Stopped. Tried to keep his idiot perplexity off his face.
"It's noble, Lord Prism, but it's not wise."
"What?" "Well, sometimes when you don't know what the hell someone's talking about, the best thing to do is play along." "I don't know what the hell you're talking about," Gavin said. "Oops."
"The freeing is the holiest moment in a drafter's life," Samilla said. "You're trying to protect that for us, and we thank you for that. But we're warriors. All of us fought in the war. We're willing to fight again."
"I die this day," Usef said. "It's my duty to make an end, and I accept that. But I've got no patience for all this Orholam this and Orholam that. I'd rather go down fighting."
"Lord Prism," Samilla Sire said, "we have to hold the city long enough for everyone to escape. Holding the walls is a death sentence. Why not give it to us? We're dead anyway."
Their talking had given Gavin a few moments to think, to recover his balance. "If I send you out there, you'll all break the halo. That's why you're here. Next year, I'll have to face you fighting for him. They don't put down color whites. It's not just your souls we're talking about here, it's your sanity. And you're right, you're all warriors. That makes you 10 times as dangerous when you break."
"We'll fight in teams, each with a pistol and a knife. When we break, we'll do as the blackguards do."
When a comrade broke the halo on the battlefield, the blackguards considered them dead, and, indeed, it did usually render a person unconscious temporarily. The blackguards would check the eyes of a fallen comrade, and if the halo was broken, they'd slit their throat.
"Except when a team's down to one, we end ourselves too," Samilla said.
It was, for some, a thorny theological point, though not without precedent. Was suicide a sin when you knew you were going mad and would likely hurt or kill innocents?
"You are the Prism. You could make a special dispensation."
"Future generations would believe that implied special dispensation is needed," Talon Ginn said, scowling. He had always had very definite theological views. Maros Orlos stepped forward.
"Lord Prism, we've already sent to be freed all the drafters we knew were too far gone to be any use on the battlefield. What is the greater good here, that we do things as they've always been done, or that we save an entire city?"
There was no contest, of course. Gavin was trembling. "I think such a sacrifice would honour Orholam. I will give each of you a special blessing as you take up this burden. I am deeply humbled by this act of devotion. Deeply grateful." That much was no lie. After making the decision to let the freeing class fight to the death instead of be freed on his knife, Gavin still met with each of them. He shrived them, listened to their concerns about dying, and blessed them. It was exactly the same as he would have done otherwise, minus the killing. But to Gavin it was entirely different. Usually he was so sickened by what he had to do that he couldn't give their words his full attention. He tried, he pretended, he knew they deserved his best. But today, he did it. They weren't really talking to him as they spoke, they were talking to Orholam. Gavin was simply an instrument to make their confessions easier than addressing an empty room. What they were doing was an act of devotion. It was an act of sacrifice. To others, it wouldn't seem that different than what some did every year at the freeing. It would end with a dead drafter who'd gone to death bravely. But without the burden of shedding their blood, Gavin was able to see it clearly for the first time. These people were heroes. If Gavin hadn't pulled one over on the whole world and on Orholam himself by masquerading as his own brother, perhaps the freeing would have seemed this holy every year.
It was supposed to be something to celebrate, but Gavin had dreaded it. Always. Now, as he prayed with each drafter, he could almost believe Orholm listened. Samilasaya was the last. She was, Gavin was reminded, a woman whose beauty withstood scrutiny. Her skin, even in her 40s, was nearly flawless. A few smile lines, but clear and glowing, slim, stunning blue eyes against Atashian olive skin. Impeccably dressed. "I had an affair with your brother, you know," she said. Gavin froze. He knew that he, Dazen, had not had an affair with Samilasaya, which could only mean one thing. She knew. "Sometimes a man likes to pretend that nothing has happened between him and an old lover," Gavin said quickly, "especially when it was a great mistake." She laughed. "I've wondered often over the years, are you just so good that you've never been discovered, or does everyone who could expose you have an ulterior motive for not doing so?" She stared at him, but he said nothing. "You know, Evie was looking at your wall." She said, "I don't remember Gavin being a super chromat. He shouldn't be able to craft a yellow this perfect." And do you know what she said after that? She said that Orholm must have blessed your effort, that it was proof you were doing his will. And everyone nodded their heads. Can you believe it? Gavin felt a chill. Gavin would have made a wall that would last a month and bragged it would last forever. You made a wall that will last forever and said it might last a few years. You just couldn't stand to make an inferior product, could you, Dazen? Someone who'd been drafting blue for 25 years would be pleased to see the order in this. Dazen was a perfectionist, so even though he could make his mask better with imperfection, it didn't match his personality to do so. "No," he said quietly. "I fought for your brother. I killed for him," Samila said. "We all did an awful lot of that," Gavin said. "I felt so betrayed by you, that you wouldn't even acknowledge me after what we'd had. I felt a glimmer of hope when you broke your betrothal with Karis. When I finally figured it all out, I still wasn't sure of myself. Gavin told us things about you, about what you would do if you won, and you weren't doing them. Was your brother a liar all along, or did you change? You were supposed to be a monster, Dazen."
"I am a monster."
"Glib, still. The snot-nosed younger brother with a quick tongue. I mean it." She looked at him long and hard, looked at the freeing knife that he hadn't drawn. "How well do you know yourself?" He thought about the years, the goals he'd achieved, and the ultimate goal it was serving.
"The philosopher said that a man alone is either a god or a monster," Gavin said. "I'm no god."
She stared at him for one moment more, those intense blue eyes unreadable. She smiled. "Well then, maybe the times call for a monster." She knelt at his feet, and he blessed her. Chapter 82 Kippert always pictured a charge as being somehow glorious. Whatever he'd pictured, it wasn't this. He held his pants up with his wounded left hand and the musket in his right, and the musket was heavy. His heart was heaving and everyone else was running faster than he was. He had little sense of what was happening anywhere else. A man who roared that the soldiers could call him either God or Master Sergeant Kalan Delelo ran at the front, urging his men on. The backs of the other soldiers filled the rest of Kip's vision, and the pain of running distracted him from all else except for the intermittent whistling, which he couldn't place at first, until he realized it was the sound of musket balls flying past, and then he could hardly think of anything else. For a moment he saw the city walls as the men in front of him disappeared in a ditch, before scrambling up the other side. He remembered dismissing these walls not even a week ago. Now they looked pretty impressive. The side of the wall was encrusted with slums, like barnacles, and King Haradul's men were already swarming there, trying to use the low buildings and rough shelters as a ladder. But even in the brief glimpse Kip had, one of the slum buildings on which the men were climbing teetered and then collapsed, crushing men and sending up a cloud of dust.
Something wet and chunky splattered across Kip's face as he ran. He turned. Vaguely he saw a man dropping beside him, and then the ground suddenly wasn't where it was supposed to be. He went down hard in the dry irrigation ditch. He skidded on his face, flipped over, rolled, the wind knocked cleanly out of him. As he moaned, struggling to regain his breath, he realized he wasn't alone. The irrigation ditch was full of men cowering inside its marginal cover. Master Sergeant Galandalelo appeared back on the lip of the ditch.
"Get up, you pathetic rats! They've got an angle right into this ditch from the wall, you damn fools! Get up! If you're anything less than dead, get up or I'll shoot you myself!"
For a second, no one moved. "You wouldn't," a man said. The Master Sergeant drew a pistol and shot him in the belly.
"Who's next?"
he yelled. He pointed his other pistol at a man carrying a large robin's egg blue sack.
"I'm a messenger," the man screamed.
"You're a soldier now," Master Sergeant Delalo shouted.
He was either unaware or just didn't care about the musket fire raining around him, sending up little puffs of earth.
"Now, move!"
The man dropped his messenger sack, grabbed Kip's musket and ran forward, along with everyone else. Lying on the ground, Kip was left with the other corpses. When he had his breath back, he touched the side of his face. Gore. Grey-red chunks of... He didn't want to think about it. What mattered was that he was free. At least until the next officer commandeered the cowards who filled up this ditch again. There wasn't much time. If Kip thought too much or waited too long, he wouldn't move, and he needed to move now. The Master Sergeant was right. This ditch wasn't out of the line of fire. If Kip waited, he was going to get killed. He wanted to see more of the battle, make a good plan. He didn't know what kind of a judge he would be of whatever he saw, and he didn't even know which way to run. He grabbed the messenger's sack and slung it over his shoulder. He saw the wreck of a wagon farther back away from the wall. Did we run right past that? Kip hadn't even noticed. Regardless, the oxen who'd been pulling the wagon were dead, or mewling, screaming in pain, blooded. Kip ran for it. He ducked into the shadow of the wagon and found two other men already there. They looked at him with wide, fearful eyes.
"Move!" he shouted.
Kip climbed up on the wreck and looked out on the plain. At first all he saw were the dead bodies, several hundred perhaps. Mostly he couldn't see any blood, so it looked like people sprawled about sleeping. It wasn't so great a toll, considering how big the army was, Kip thought, but seeing so many dead wasn't really something he could merely think about. Those people were dead. He could have been one of them. He could still be. He tore his eyes away, tried to look for something useful. In a few spots at the wall, King Haradul's men had actually reached the top of the wall. There was fighting in three or four places, defenders and attackers alike being thrown off, grappling, puffs of black smoke erupting everywhere from musket and pistol fire. To Kip's left there was a slight hill, out of range of musket fire from the wall. There were several hundred horsemen and drafters around the hill. In front of the hill, drafters were crafting a bridge over the irrigation ditch. Kip saw then that the original bridge had been destroyed by the retreating people of Garriston. It had slowed King Haradul's advance, probably more because they'd stopped to talk about it than if they had simply charged the horses through. At the top of the hill, Kip saw standard-bearers and a figure who might have been King Haradul himself. He was shouting, making huge animated movements toward Lord Omnichrome, who was unmistakable because he literally glowed in the early morning light. Kip didn't realize he'd made a decision until he found himself running. He snatched a musket from the ground next to a woman curled in the fetal position, moaning, and kept running. His vengeance was this close. As Kip approached the hill, movement began on the hill and rapidly spread, horns sounding orders. It was a few seconds before Kip saw the horses moving. King Haradul was advancing on the wall, personally, right toward the Mother's Gate. Was he trusting that his men would open the gate by the time he got there, or was he just an idiot? Kip was halfway up the hill when he saw a woman whose form seemed familiar. He stopped. Carys Whiteoak had flagged down one of the horsemen heading after King Haradul. The man slowed down for her, and she swung up into the saddle behind him with surprising grace. The man turned in the saddle to ask her a question, and then tumbled out. Kip saw the quick gleam of a dagger, then it was sheathed, and Carys kicked the horse's sides and went speeding after King Haradul. She was going by herself, with her eye caps still on. She wouldn't be able to draft, but she was still going to try to kill him. Even if she was successful, it would be suicide. I swore to save her. And I swore to kill him. Kip was a terrible rider, but there was no way he could catch up without a horse. Seeing horses tied up near the crown of the hill, he headed straight for them.
"Through the Lover's Gate! You'll have to swim! Join the refugees! He'll—"
Kip rounded a tent in time to see the young drafter Zymon swing up into a saddle. He was taking orders from Lord Omnichrome himself. Kip's heart leaped. They weren't 20 paces away.
"You need a horse?"
someone said right at Kip's elbow. Kip almost jumped out of his skin. He blinked stupidly at the groom.
"Rough work out there, huh?"
the groom said.
"Message,"
Kip said, remembering he was carrying a messenger bag.
"Message for the king. Yes, a horse. I need a horse. I figured,"
the man said. He went off to find a beast, large enough. Kip looked back toward Lord Omnichrome and Zymon. He missed whatever else they said, but he saw Lord Omnichrome hand a box to the mounted drafter. That box. Kip couldn't believe it. That was his box. Right size, right shape. That was his inheritance, the only thing his mother had ever given him, and Zymon had it. Zymon bowed to Lord Omnichrome. Kip sank back as the young drafter pulled his horse around and galloped away to the east. Lord Omnichrome strode back toward the crown of the hill. The groom brought Kip a horse and helped him mount and stash the musket in a sleeve beside the saddle. Kip looked, torn. Lord Omnichrome was disappearing up the hill, rejoining his entourage. He was the heart of this. Kip knew it. He should kill him. Or Hollum, his chance was passing through his fingertips. But to the south, Caris was charging to her death, and to the east, that snake Zymon was stealing the only thing Kip had to remember his mother by. Kill Lord Omnichrome and stop the war. Kill Zymon and take the knife. Or save Caris and have a chance at King Haradul. Kip couldn't get them all. Kip had made his oaths to the living and to the dead. He gritted his teeth, sure he was making the wrong decision, and making it anyway. It's better that the innocent should live than that the guilty die. Gavin loved Caris, and he deserved another chance at happiness. Kip rode after her.
Chapter 83. Caris had never fought in a full-scale battle before, but she had watched several with Gavin's general Running Wolf. In another age, he would have been revered as a great leader. Instead, he'd faced Corvin Danavis, and been thrice bested by smaller forces commanded by the mustachioed genius. Regardless, he'd been a kindly older gentleman with a soft spot for Caris, and he would explain to her what he was seeing as the distant lines clashed. Of course, he was often too busy to tell her much, but at other times it seemed to help him to think out loud. So now, as Caris galloped down the hill and headed toward the fray, she was able to piece together more than she would have otherwise. The buildings propped against both sides of the wall, the feature that would eventually doom it, Caris was sure, were actually helping in the short term. They were like a talus slope, wide enough that it encumbered anyone bringing forward siege ladders and too unpredictable to charge men straight up at any one place. Eventually, King Haradul's men would figure out which places were stable and how much weight they could support, but until then the collapsing buildings killed and slowed the men attacking the wall. As Caris rode in, drafters appeared at the top of the wall en masse for the first time. The wall wasn't high, but it was wide enough for the defenders to move along the top at great speed, and they'd seen King Haradul's cavalry coming here. Reds and sub-reds worked in teams from the top of the walls, one flinging sticky pyre jelly down onto the attackers, and the other setting it alight. King Haradul had a line of his own drafters up front, blues and greens, attempting to divert the pyre jelly in midair and throw it back at the wall. Reds threw their own Luxin up at the defenders on the wall, though Haradul's teams weren't as good at getting it alight every time. On both sides, musketeers did their best to pick off drafters. The defenders were getting the best of it, but there were simply so many attackers, Caris didn't see how they could possibly hold out for long. And why had King Haradul brought his cavalry here now? Directly against the wall, their maneuverability was negated, and they made easy targets for the blue drafters at the top of the wall, who would pop out from behind the crenellations, fire off a few daggers of blue, and then duck back down. All Caris had to do was muscle her way through the crowd, not hard when you were mounted, steal a musket, stay alive long enough to get close to King Haradul, and blow his head off. In the heat and fury and blood and confusion and cacophony of battle, it was quite possible no one would even realize the killing shot had come from behind him. Caris heard a yell behind her, somehow different from the rest of the screams. She turned her head, still leaning low over her galloping horse, a dozen Mirrormen coming after her on their gigantic chargers. Her heart convulsed. So the subtle approach isn't going to work. She picked at the eye caps again. The skin at the corner of her eye was tearing, but she wasn't any closer to pulling the damned things off. If she could draft, she would have a chance. She pushed down the sudden flood of red fury with effort. 80 paces out, she saw a line of musketeers reloading. She scanned the crowd for anyone bearing a flintlock. A matchlock wouldn't work for this. Then, slowing her horse to get the timing right, she swept in just as one of the officers finished reloading and hefted the musket up to his shoulder. She snatched it right out of his hands. Commander Ironfist had often chided her for her trick riding, for practicing things they both knew had no use beyond impressing the Blackguard's new recruits. A vision of the big man's head, shaking in amused surrender, went through her head as she jammed the musket into the saddle sleeve. She was wearing this damned dress that left her half naked and half totally restricted. She wasn't really going to... Caris kicked her feet free of the stirrups, turned her wrist behind her back to get a firm grip on the cantle, tucked the reins between horse and pommel, and dismounted as the horse continued at a canter. She hit the ground and instantly leapt, twisting, feeling the sleeves of her dress rip. She'd always practiced this with a better cantle, but she'd also practiced on taller horses, and she almost flung herself over the side of the saddle on her way back up. It took her half a moment, but she settled into the saddle, backward. She drew the musket, leveled it, trying to absorb as much of the shock of the horse's cantering in her knees as she could, trying to time how long it would take between trigger pull and musket fire. She aimed at the lead Mirrorman 40 paces behind her and pulled the trigger. She'd aimed perfectly, timed everything right, but the musket didn't fire. She cocked the flintlock again, checked the mechanism. No flint. It had fallen out, probably during her impressive trick riding. Bollocks. Caris threw the musket away, reversed her hands, turned her head over her shoulder to make sure she'd be leaping off flat ground, and dismounted. The reverse dismount and remount was actually much harder than the original trick, but she did it perfectly, both feet hitting the ground, pushing off in tandem just as the pull of the horse's forward motion catapulted her into the air. Except as she was pulled up and forward, half of her horse's head was torn off by a musket ball and its body dove for the earth. If she'd still been holding the reins, she'd have been flung to earth too. Instead, she became a human cannonball. The force of her jump and the horse's sudden dive had her twisting like a cat. She was flying, upside down, and backward. Time only for one thought. Roll when you hit. But when she hit, there was no time for anything at all. Whatever it was, there were multiple levels, and it was mercifully soft, which didn't stop it from whipping her head and limbs in different directions. When she finally hit ground, she couldn't move for a few long seconds. Someone was cursing. She saw feet. She was lying on top of a man, and he was struggling to get out from under her. She must have crashed into the backs of half a dozen soldiers and taken them all out with her. One man had his leg twisted at a nasty angle. Another turned to look at her, his nose fountaining blood, cursing. A huge explosion took away whatever he was saying, perhaps 60 paces away. Everything seemed to freeze for a moment on the battlefield. Then things began moving too fast to take them all in at once. Caris jumped to her feet and almost collapsed. She was so light-headed that it took all of her concentration not to fall. She checked herself quickly. There were stinging abrasions on her arms and legs, dress in pathetic shape, but no serious wounds. She touched her eyes. The eye caps were unbroken, of course, and smudged with blood so they were harder to see through. Just perfect. Now that she was in the midst of the battle, the world narrowed. There were images like little paintings, but no hole. Caris saw a drafter up on the Mother's Gate. Eisenblue? What was he doing here?
He stood, skin fully blue, both arms extended, shooting blue daggers in rapid succession. An absolutely stunning display to work so fast, keeping his will focused, shooting from both hands. He was like a dozen musketeers. 3 dozen, despite the hazy quality of the morning's misty sunlight. Everywhere he turned, men went down. He turned toward the mirror men, and Caris saw those blue blades shearing off in every direction from the mirror armor, chewing through everyone around the mirror men, but sometimes catching a chink or hitting the mirror armor flat enough that a knife punched through. A body stood in front of Caris, headless, its neck spraying blood in time with the last beats of its heart. The sound of muskets firing and the roar of blood in her ears melded together. A pulse, life and death, twined together. The mirror men surged toward a hole in the wall, perhaps 7 paces across, so that was where the explosion had been. A red drafter, one of King Haradul's free, had gone mad. He was cackling, throwing pyre jelly on everyone around him. The men splattered with the stuff were shouting in fear. Someone was begging him to stop. A man was falling off the shattered edge of the wall, slipping, screaming. Off to one side, atop the wall, the sun gleamed off a man's copper hair, Caris's eyes locked on him. Gavin! He leaned close to another man, issued an order, Corvin Danavis. So the man really was a general. And he was here? Gavin clapped the man on the shoulder, and they parted. Caris turned, remembering the pursuing mirror men, perhaps too late. The leader was 20 paces back, horse surging through the lines, shouting at men to move aside, sword drawn. He was alone, his men cut off behind him by a sudden sideways surge in the line, but he was too close. Caris was unarmed and still wobbly on her feet. 10 paces away, her pursuer seemed to jump in his saddle. Caris could see the whole front of his body, so he hadn't been shot from the wall, but nonetheless, he tumbled out of his saddle. Someone had killed the man from behind. What the hell? Caris looked behind the man. Kip. Kip! The young man was riding at a full gallop behind the mirror men, following the path they'd pushed open through the ranks of soldiers, but he didn't have a musket. Instead, he was carrying a big green ball, larger than his own head. His skin was green, and he had a wild look in his eyes, and he looked like he was going to tumble out of the saddle at any moment. Not seeming to care that he was guiding his horse directly into other horses, Kip drew the green globe backward like he was throwing a ball. Classic Tyro misperception. They always thought that because a ball had mass, you had to muscle it. Kip's arm came forward, and then with an audible pop, he shot the green globe out at the mirror men. It caught one in the side of his mirrored helmet. The mirror armor sheared Luxin easily, but it still had to deal with the momentum of what was hitting it. A breastplate might withstand a bullet, but the man inside was still going to have some broken ribs. Here the man's head snapped to the side, blasting him out of the saddle, and the green globe ricocheted off, hitting another mirror man's shoulder and not quite dismounting him, then caromed into a third mirror man's horse, catching the animal on the side of its head and knocking it off its feet. The force of the shot blew Kip out of his own saddle, almost halting all of his forward motion. His horse shied, trying not to collide with the others at the last second, but they had been startled by riders falling and a giant green ball flying past their heads, and one dodged directly into its new path. Animal collided with animal at great speed, crunching a mirror man's leg that was trapped between them. Both horses went down, but Caris was more concerned about Kip. She lost sight of him when he fell. Soldiers were still a river, pressing past the mirror men, not knowing or caring much what this fight was about. They just wanted to get out of the shadow of these deadly walls and into the city. Caris snatched a sword off the ground and ducked through the crowd. 3 riders had wheeled around and were pushing toward a spot farther back. She couldn't get there in time. One was drawing his musket from the saddle sheath to kill her when his head exploded in a burst of yellow light and pink mist. Caris was sure this time the shot hadn't come from the wall. It had to have come from the opposite direction. From the hill? And what the hell could have done that? An explosive musket ball? She was still too far away. She saw 2 mirror men pulling muskets out, aiming down. 2 green spears, pillars, almost, they were so thick, erupted from the ground where the riders were pointing and impaled them. The first one was hit square in the chest, Green light fractured out in a spray as the mirrored breastplate held for a moment, and then burst. And still the green spear shot up, lifting the mirror man up into the air. The other man was no more lucky. That spear hit the top of his breastplate, again shearing some Luxon away into a flash of green light. Then the spear rode up, catching him under the chin and going into his head, ripping his helmet off his ruined head like a child popping the head off a dandelion. Each was lifted several paces into the air before the green Luxon spears cracked and dropped them to the ground and dissolved to nothing. Kip jumped to his feet, looking a lot less dead than he deserved. Caris arrived a moment later. He gave her a curious look, and she said, "Kip, it's me. Do you recognize me? It's Caris." Despite that astounding display of power, Kip was a new drafter, and the mental and emotional effects of the colors were always greatest when you first started. The wildness of green could make a drafter dangerous. He lifted a hand quickly, and she flinched.
"Kip, it's me, Caris," she said,
all too aware that there was still a battle going on, though the amount of musket fire from the top of the wall had dwindled to almost nothing.
"Hold still," he said, staring intently at her face. He brought up a single finger and moved it as if to poke her in the eye. She could feel the heat radiating from it.
What? Kip was a sub-red, too? There was a hiss as he touched the eye cap, and he must have hit the fuse point, because the eye cap dissolved. Then he did the other. And like that, Caris could draft again. Oh, hell yes.
"What do you say?" Kip asked.
What was he talking about?
"Thank you," Caris asked.
"I say we go kill us a king," Kip said, grinning recklessly. When they were in the grip of their color, greens didn't tend to be real big on common sense. Caris looked and saw that Rask Haradul was just getting to the gap they'd blown in the wall. Half of his men were already through. It was the perfect time to attack. Well, other than the fact that Caris and Kip were on the side of the wall with King Haradul's entire army. Drafting some red off the pools of gore around them, Caris felt the comforting wash of red rage. She felt strong.
"Let's go kill us a king," she said.
Chapter 84 "I'm not important enough for this," Liv thought as Lord Omnichrome came back to the top of the hill where she was tied up. From her vantage point, she could see a familiar form taking a big red stallion from a groom, then mounting. Kip. If he turned around, he couldn't help but see her. For a moment, Liv wasn't sure if she wanted him to see her or not. She had no doubt what he would do if he did. He'd come charging up the hill, and to hell with the odds. That was Kip. That was who he was and who he always had been, not always smart, but always ferociously loyal. She ducked her head. There was only death here for Kip. And sure enough, he turned for one second as he sat unsteadily atop the big horse. Then he kicked his heels in and almost tumbled out of the saddle as the animal surged forward. Liv almost grinned at the sight, but the looming figure of Lord Omnichrome wiped away any thought of amusement. As he came close, she realized he wasn't as big as he seemed from a distance. His white robes and the white cape hanging off great blue horns rising from his shoulders made him seem bigger than a mortal man, but he wasn't even as tall as Gavin Gile. But he glowed. It was like yellow Luxon filled his veins instead of blood. His hair had been sculpted into a spiky crown with yellow Luxon, so it dazzled, as if he'd been crowned by the sun itself, and his eyes beneath were a constant riot of colors. And he was staring at her. "I'm not important enough for this," she thought again. Her cheek was throbbing, still dribbling blood. The powder wagon's explosion had knocked her unconscious, and shrapnel had cut her in a dozen places. She didn't know how they'd found her among all the bodies. She didn't know why they would want her.
"How did you come to be here, Olivia Danavis?"
"I walked, mostly," she said.
Danavis. So that was it. They knew her father was commanding the enemy army, and she'd stupidly delivered herself into their hands. Well done, Liv. Lord Omnichrome's retainers surrounded them, broken, haloed drafters of every type, soldiers, messengers, and a few high-ranking officers from King Haradul's camp who looked decidedly uneasy around all the drafters, much less Lord Omnichrome. Lord Omnichrome picked up a strange musket as long as he was tall. He lifted it, fitted its leg into a slot on the barrel, propped it up in front of himself, and aimed down the hill toward the fighting.
"Dead center on that green door," he said.
"Third house from the left?" a spotter asked. Liv didn't know much about muskets, but she knew you couldn't make a shot that accurate at 300 paces. Not that you'd want someone shooting in your direction, but past 100 paces, aiming was more a general hope. Nonetheless, Lord Omnichrome took a deep breath, sighted down the barrel through the mists, fired. The musket roared.
"Three hands high, one hand left," the spotter said.
Lord Omnichrome handed the musket to an attendant who began reloading it. He turned to Liv.
"I want you to join me, Liv. I saw you last night, listening. You understood. I could tell you did."
Or Hollum. She thought he'd looked at her. But then she dismissed it as her imagination. There had been thousands listening last night, and how did he recognize her?
"You love your father, don't you, Liv?"
"More than anything," he said. How did he know her name, much less her nickname?
"And how old is he?"
"Maybe 40," she said.
"Old, then? For a drafter. If he weren't a drafter, he could live another 40 years. But as a drafter loyal to the Chromeria, he's an old dog already, isn't he? Most men don't make it to 40. Your father must be very disciplined, very strong."
"Stronger than you know," Liv said. She felt a surge of emotion. Who was this bastard, talking about her father? She wouldn't let anyone speak badly of him. He was a great man, even if he had made mistakes. The attendant handed the long musket back to Lord Omnichrome. He raised it, stabilized its significant weight on its leg, and said,
"Blue drafter, just right of the gatehouse."
Liv watched, horrified, as Lord Omnichrome waited. The blue drafter was ducked behind a crenellation, popping up to throw death down on the men below and ducking down again. He popped up. Lord Omnichrome said,
"Hot!"
The musket roared. A burst of light and blood, and the drafter disappeared from view.
"Shoulder, your left," the attendant said. "One hand left and three thumbs high."
Lord Omnichrome handed the musket back to the man with a polite thank you.
"When the time comes, will you tell them?"
he asked Liv.
"Tell them? Tell them about my father," Liv hesitated. "I'll do what I need to do."
"What you need to do? Interesting how they make it that, isn't it? What if you couldn't make it back to Chromeria in time? Would you kill your father yourself with your own hand? What if he asked you to stop? What if he begged you?"
"My father isn't such a coward."
"You're dodging the question."
Lord Omnichrome's eyes were swirling orange. Liv had never liked oranges much. Always unnerved her. When she didn't speak for a long moment, he said,
"I understand perfectly. When I started my own Chromeria, I followed them blindly at first, too, despite what I am. One of my students broke their halo and I murdered her with my own hands. She wasn't the first to die for the drafter's ignorance, nor the last, but she was the beginning of the end. When I killed her, I knew what I did was wrong. I couldn't shake it."
"Drafters go mad. Like you. They turn on their friends. They kill those they love."
"Oh, absolutely. Sometimes. Some people can't handle power. Some men seem decent until you give them a slave, and soon they're a tyrant, beating and raping the slave in their charge. Power is a test, Liv. All power is a test. We don't call it breaking the halo, we call it breaking the egg. You never know what kind of bird is going to be hatched. And some are born deformed and must be put down. That is tragedy, but not murder. You think your father could handle a little extra power? The great Corvin Danavis? An immensely talented drafter who's nevertheless had the discipline to make it to 40?
"It's not that simple," Liv said.
"What if it is? What if the Chromeria has perpetuated this monstrosity because this is how they keep themselves in power? By scaring the satrapies, saying that only they can train the drafters born among them, for a price, always for a price, and only they can restrain the drafters who go mad, which is all of them. By doing that, they make themselves forever useful, forever powerful, and by divvying out drafters to the satrapies, they make themselves the center of everything. Tell me, Liv, when you judge the Chromeria by its fruit,
Do you find it a place of love and peace and light, as one might expect from Orholm's holy city?
No, Liv admitted. She didn't even know why she was defending it, except out of stubbornness. The Chromeria was everything she hated, and it defiled all it touched, including her. She owed debts there, and she couldn't lie to herself so much that she would believe her flight to Tyria and to follow Kip wasn't partly a flight from her debt to Aglaia Krassos and Hrothgar.
The truth is, Liv, you know I'm right. You're just afraid to admit you've been on the wrong side. I understand. We all do. There are good men and women who fight against us, good people, but they're deluded, deceived. It hurts to leave a lie, but it hurts more to live one. Look at what I'm doing. I'm freeing a city that's ours by rights. Garriston has been passed around like a whore to be abused by every nation in turn. It's not right. It has to end. And since no one else will end it, we will. Does not this land deserve freedom? Should these people pay because two brothers, neither of whom was born here or cared a whit for this land, fought here? For how long should they pay?
They shouldn't, Liv said.
Because it isn't just.
He took the long musket from the attendant again.
Red Drafter, top of the gatehouse. Head.
Liv watched. The battle in front of the Mother's Gate was hard.